Lord, break the bread of your word among us that we may be nourished by your truth. Amen. So the lot fell upon Matthias. What is it like to be chosen? This afternoon at Wembley Stadium, Bristol Rovers will be playing Grimsby Town in the conference playoff final. For those of you to whom this means absolutely nothing, the winning team will get back into the Football League as Oxford United did a few seasons ago. I was brought up in a family with a long history of involvement in Grimsby Town, right back to its Victorian origins. And I can tell you that I had no choice in the matter at all. By the time I was able to think and to read, I was already a supporter. I can tell you what it means to be chosen. Occasional flashes of hope, which always manage to dissolve into a sea of disappointment. I was chosen, and there's nothing I can do but grin and bear it. And in all probability, by 4 o'clock this afternoon, resign myself to more of the same. It all reminds me of the prophet Jeremiah, who announces at the beginning of the book, which bears his name, that God called him to speak the word of the Lord before he was born. And he has to bear the consequences, mostly having a rough time of it at the hands of his contemporaries. Usually, though, we have a bit more say in the matter. It may not entirely surprise you that when teams were being chosen for rugby or cricket at school, I would always be among the very last to be picked. Jesus said that in God's kingdom, the first would be last and the last first, but his words offered scant comfort in such moments. For when someone is chosen, others will feel rejected. My late Uncle Stephen, notably eccentric, partly as a result of his traumatic wartime experiences in the Libyan desert, once stood as a deacon in his local congregational church and was not elected. For years afterwards, he would refer to himself, not without a degree of sadness, as a failed deacon. On the other hand, being chosen or elected comes with its own temptations to think of oneself as better than, superior to, the person you've beaten to it. And when it comes to being a chosen people, that danger is magnified. Many pages of the Old Testament writings are taken up with arguments about what this implies. Does it give you special privileges and rights which others don't have, so that you can exercise your superiority over them? Or does it confer moral and spiritual responsibilities, which are actually hard to bear? Many of us made a choice last Thursday week. A few nights before the general election, we were talking after dinner in college about whether or not voting should be compulsory, given that a third of the population prefers not to exercise its democratic rights. Some people thought that online voting was the way forward. Others, like me, rather like the distinctly low-tech way in which you stand in a basic little partition and use a stubby little pencil attached to a piece of string to mark your X on the paper. On the night, as the results flowed in, we watched winners who were delighted and losers who were gutted. Some of the latter will no doubt go on to lucrative careers elsewhere, but others will struggle. So spare a thought for poor old Joseph Barsabbas, also known as Justus, the losing candidate when the apostles cast lots to fill the vacancy left by Judas Iscariot, and the lot fell upon Matthias. We don't know how he took it or what he did thereafter. He disappears from view, as losers tend to. But, and it's an important but, he is part of the story of everyone who seeks to follow in the way of Jesus, and especially those who fail. We've all agonised over choices, schools, careers, moving house, commitments of various kinds. And together they shape our future, which is why human history is full of rituals and customs intended to help us make them. Ancient Israel had the Urim and Thummim, part of the high priest's breastplate, which could be consulted as oracles. In the classical world, poets were believed to be inspired by the gods, none more so than Virgil. If you were faced with a decision and wanted to know what the future held for you, you might open his epic poem, the Aeneid, at a random page, and wherever your finger pointed, the text would be interpreted as prophetic. This practice, known as the Sortes Virgilianae, was also used with the Bible. There's a famous example in the story of the conversion of St. Augustine from paganism to Christianity in the 4th century. As he was reading in a garden, he heard a child's voice singing, "Tolle et lege," take up and read. He opened his Bible and his eye fell on verses from Romans 13. "Let us live honourably as in the day, not in debauchery and licentiousness, not in quarrelling and jealousy. Instead, put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires." Since he was rather a naughty boy, these words hit home. And if you happened to have watched Professor McCulloch's recent series on Christianity and sex, you'll know all about the consequences. In the University of Salamanca in the 16th century, then one of Europe's leading intellectual centres, professors of biblical studies had to undergo a version of this practice. As part of what we would call the interview process, a Bible would be opened at random and a finger pointed at a text on the page, whereupon the candidate had to expound that text to the best of his abilities. They must have prayed hard to avoid getting Leviticus. It feels now to us like superstition. We don't choose ministers by making them preach on a text selected in that way, and we don't choose our elders by casting lots. But we still fret when choices have to be made. And while there's not much harm in feeling a glow of satisfaction if we succeed in an application or are elected to an office, the Christian virtue of humility can be harder to maintain. It's a natural human reaction to think that if we knew what the future held, what the consequences of our choices might be, we'd make better decisions to begin with. But we don't have that luxury. We have to make them as best we can, uncertain if they are the right ones, and haunted when things don't go according to plan by the siren song of the "if only." The lot fell upon Matthias. David Cameron won an overall majority. The New Testament speaks of Christians as chosen by God. But chosen for what? For rewards others cannot have? For approval they are denied? Think again. When Jesus says to his disciples, "You did not choose me, I chose you," he continues, "And I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last." Clearly then, there is a purpose in being so chosen, a creative and an enduring one. We are not chosen because we are special or uniquely favoured. We are simply chosen to nurture seeds into flower and flower into fruit in the garden of the Lord for divine horticulture, not human self-aggrandizement. To plant for solid joys and lasting treasures, as John Newton would put it in his hymn. The images are beautiful, compelling even, but they will not touch us as they should if we don't translate them into our own time and experience. I was struck, therefore, by two quite different words which Jesus emphasises in John 17, one of them the world, and the other sanctify or consecrate. At first time, they seem unconnected and unhelpful. Jesus is speaking in negative terms of what he calls the world, which seems to give legitimacy to all those world-denying tendencies found in religious traditions, yet surely alien to a faith based on incarnation, on God's embrace of materiality. Consecrate or sanctify is one of those religious words which float in the air, disconnected from our earth realities. But John is a subtle writer, and he doesn't fall into those traps. We should not read about the negative world here without remembering the most famous text of all in John 3, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. The world remains the same, cosmos in Greek, but the meaning has shifted. There is a world of need into which the Christ has been born to raise it up out of its fallen state. And there is a world which will always resist that process, a world which persecutes and kills the very one who comes to save it from itself. This second world is the one we know all too well, with us in the pages of our papers, on the screens of our televisions and computers, a world full of violence and cruelty, of people fleeing war and persecution, of governments which slaughter their citizens, of politicians who mouth words of hatred in the way the psalmist so memorably calls, words softer than oil, yet were they drawn swords. It is also the world which is found in each one of us when self-interest triumphs over the common good and when we become agents of hurt and not healing. We all know that world and the damage it inflicts. Can its hold on us ever be broken? We dream of it and we despair of it, and it is precisely for this that God sent his Son into it. He came then, is present now, to heal the world, to consecrate it, to make it whole, holy. The words, variations on the same theme. Christian disciples do not belong to the world in the sense that their values are not those which bring so much sorrow to so many. They cry out and work for justice wherever it is denied, locally, nationally, across the globe. They seek to build peace, not fan the flames of terror and war. They show a generosity of spirit, compassion, love in action, wherever narrowness, indifference, and recrimination squeeze out hope from the human heart. Such, Paul tells us, are the fruits of the Spirit, and changing the image but not the idea, the garments God's chosen ones are to wear. In this or any small congregation, it would be foolish to assume that we must single-handedly change the world or count ourselves as failures and give up. The world we are called to consecrate is usually to be found on our doorsteps, though of course we shall want to be engaged as far as we can, in larger campaigns to rid the world of everything that prevents people from living in freedom and equality. It is to make this gospel heard and seen and practiced that we are chosen in succession to all those before us who have let the light of Christ shine through their words and deeds. However often we fail, however inadequate we feel, that is our calling. And when we respond, gifts of grace come to us, sufficient even in our weakness to enable us to continue Christ's ministry. A word of warning, though. Don't expect plaudits. The joy of quiet service is its own reward. Expect resistance and expect criticism. They are signs that you are on the disciples' road, which not for nothing is called the way of the cross. On that road, no one is chosen because they are worth more in the sight of God than anyone else, and it is often rough underfoot. Christians choose to follow the way of Christ because it unmasks hypocrisy and smugness, first of all in themselves, because it lets the fullness of our humanity out of the prisons in which we keep it chained. And in so choosing, we find that the lot has already fallen upon us. Unable to keep quiet when the voice of protest must be heard, running counter to the culture we inhabit, wherever it diminishes individuals or harms creation. Patiently, humbly, persistently, working for the triumph of love.